You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Breadline from the Australian Unemployed Workers Union on Community Radio 3CR.
So put down that job plan and listen to us.
I'd first like to acknowledge that this program is being broadcast from the lands of the Wurundjeri of the Kulin Nation. So their sovereignty was never ceded, and we want to pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. And we also acknowledge that the unfairness of the welfare system disproportionately affects First Nations people.
Hello, hello everybody, and welcome to another rip-roaring, exciting episode of the Breadline Show. And I'm very happy to have with me tonight Danielle. How are you, Danielle?
Good, thanks.
Fantastic. All right. Now, we've got a lot to get through today. Danielle, what did you bring us tonight?
Brought an interview from a chat earlier in the week with Gemma, who's the Secretary of the Australian Unemployed Workers Union.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking about the intersections within the system and how that disproportionately affects individuals with intersectionality and what that means.
Hi, my name is Danielle, and I'm here with Gemma, the Secretary of the Australian Unemployed Workers Union, who has agreed to talk to us about intersectionality and how the system disproportionately affects us through its structures. Could you start by describing a bit about your experience of intersectionality and how that affects the self in your day-to-day living in the system?
Yeah, absolutely. So intersectionality, for those who aren't aware of the concept, is basically that most of us have a bunch of different axes or ways in which we experience systemic oppression, whether that be through an identity or a capability or lack thereof or that sort of thing. So in my case, as an example, I am trans, I am in my mid-50s, I am femme-presenting, which subjects me to some misogyny. I am also have relatively low passing privilege, as some people would put it, in the trans community, which means that I am also subject to some level of trans misogyny, and misandry. So there's a bunch of those sorts of things. I'm also disabled. I have a bunch of physical capability issues, and I also have raging ADHD, which I can't get a diagnosis for because of systemic barriers in our healthcare system. All of those things on their own might not be a huge deal when it comes to finding gainful employment or accessing government services, those sorts of things. But every time one of those things stacks up with another thing, the treatment of the system on people who have those intersections with the different types of systemic disenfranchisement ends up becoming something that's a bit more serious and a bit more intransigent, a problem for overcoming the humps and the headwinds that we all face. As such, the system is not very good at acknowledging the additive and multiplicative factors that all of those different intersections apply. If I was First Nations Australian, I would find myself in a very different set of additional disenfranchisement. I have a fair bit of white privilege, so that allows me access to some technology and funding sources that might not be available to people who are Indigenous or immigrant or who don't have the language skills that I have. So, yeah, these things all stack up to make people feel not only like they have no power to influence the outcomes that they have, but also have very real consequences in terms of mental health and, your sense of personhood in the face of all of the disadvantages that you face.
And I suppose not only discrimination on a personal level, perhaps when you're dealing with individuals providing services, but also what are the intersections within different departments, say, like between, you know, when you go from disability to job seeker or age pension, how that overlays with, you said,
and that you can't get that ADHD diagnosis. So the shortfalls of the medical system or any other systems that you can think of.
Yeah, well, our healthcare system isn't designed for poor people. It's designed for people who have a reasonable amount of disposable income that they can make a contributory payment to, for especially for anything that requires specialist care. GPs will flatly refuse most of the time to diagnose ADHD. They claim they don't have the training, they don't have the expertise to be able to provide anything approaching an actual medical diagnosis. So that means that they simply won't, more often than not, which means you've then got to start engaging with the psychiatric or psychological assessment side of things. Things like neurodiversity tend not to be well supported by Medicare. Autism spectrum diagnoses are easier to get with a bit of help from the healthcare system's safety nets, but that's because there's a perception that autism is a greater economic disadvantage than ADHD. A lot of ADHD people would argue against that proposition because we have one of the big problems with ADHD is it creates a lot of executive function issues. So being able to get out of bed in the morning at the same time every day, getting out of the house can require overcoming some pretty significant activation thresholds and that sort of thing. You know, getting into the shower can be a chore. Getting into clothing can be a chore. If you're working in a professional job as a femme person, then the issue of maybe feeling like you have to put on a certain degree of makeup and hairdo and all of those sorts of things can be a threshold that you overcome. And those things don't, you know, they're pretty much automatic for a lot of typical people. But for people on the neurodivergent spectrums, like autism and ADHD, just even the idea that you have to actually get those things done feels like a load and an imposition. Problem is, our healthcare system doesn't understand that. Our government doesn't understand that. There needs to be a lot more work in helping government to understand a whole heap of things that they fundamentally don't want to understand, because if they did understand these things, they then feel an obligation to actually fix them.
Just on that, there's two things that come up for me, I guess. Your opinion perhaps on the NDIS, if it effectiveness for neurodivergent people, and also after the recent election, the ALP made a bunch of promises. I saw an article that they're going to get straight into it in regards to Medicare. Do you think that will change anything?
Look, the ALP government last election, look, not this most recent one, they went in saying they were going to do a whole bunch of stuff, and whole bunch of stuff never got done. They have basically aimed their sights pretty much squarely on the neoliberal status quo, which means that what's economically feasible and economically achievable and where does the money come from for this and where does the money come from that, that's the only thing that they're really allowing to guide their decision making. And that's the same rationale that the Liberal and National parties use when they're in government, but they're a little more specifically and explicitly pro-business, whereas the ALP likes to be pro-business and pro-jobs and pro-work without actually being quite so blunt about their support for the corporate sector. The problem, I haven't actually seen the ALP's election stump this year, this time round, other than they wanted to do a bit more work with mental health. My understanding is that ADHD wasn't part of that conversation, nor were there a great deal of supports for other forms of neurodivergence, for example, manic depression, dissociative identity disorders, and things like bipolar syndrome. And the other one is
borderline
personality disorder. Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a great deal of explicit support for that either. So the big question is, what does the ALP government want to do? I'd love to hear that they're actually going to do something meaningful. And if they do, then we will praise them for that. And I say we in the sense of the Australian Unemployed Workers Union.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia.
We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
If the government chooses to continue to focus on, let's say, cancer and bullying, some of the things, the cancer treatments that had been defunded in the MBS back into the MBS, so that those treatments could continue and help people without breaking the bank, then that'd be great. But we also have an expectation that they bridge the gaps that have been left unbridged through the entirety of their first term and in some cases made considerably worse.
Did you have a specific opinion on the NDIS as for people with neurodivergent?
Yeah, look, I'm going to be honest. I have not tried to engage with the NDIS because my personal situation is such that I don't think there's much that the NDIS can actually offer me as an individual. As in terms of the penny pinching in the NDIA that has been kicked off by Bill Shorten and will undoubtedly continue after his departure from the parliamentary party after the recent election, who knows? I do suspect that the technocratic penny pinching will continue. In doing so, that will most definitely, almost certainly undermine the benefits that the NDIS might be able to offer to people. And I'm certain that the quibbling in the NDIA over eligibility for NDIS will continue to hurt people who have mental health issues over more explicitly debilitating kinds of challenges. I've got a friend who has autism spectrum disorder, but they are also suffering from fibromyalgia and they have cystic fibrosis. So as an example, for them, getting NDIS access has been, I won't say trivial, but it's been achievable. It's taken them 3 years, though, to engage with the NDIS system and get approval for help, which is only just coming now. Despite some of these diagnoses being, you know, lifetime long or quite explicitly stated in the last couple of years. So the question is, if it's that hard for someone with incredibly debilitating disabilities to get NDIS support, then what does that equation look like for the rest of us? I think it needs to be more broadly available, and I think there needs to be some potential governance over wastage in the system and people claiming for services that they've never delivered and all of those sorts of things. Yeah, get the fraud out by all means. But, you know, I think there's also a bigger question that the NDIS brings up. It's one that a lot of people don't really want to have, and that's the role of community in providing these services. Where are the neighbours? Where are the family members? Where are the friends who might be able to make a meaningful contribution to this sort of thing? I'm a big fan of community organising and community doing for community. And I think that's kind of missing from the conversation around NDIS. And I think that's to some degree deliberate, because I don't think governments want us thinking about what we can do for each other as communities.
Any other things that you would like to wrap up on how the gap between servicing the poor under capitalism versus anarchy and mutual aid?
Yeah, I think it is a good pivot into the concept of mutual aid and that sort of thing. Although I will state that I've been on a call today with some social service organisations that where we've been discussing concepts like mutual obligations and that sort of thing. And I think one of the things that I've highlighted in that discussion was relevant mentioning here, and that's that the forces of business and capitalism only really have any interest in addressing these kinds of problems where they can actually address some level of mutual benefit. They have to profit from that process.
Yeah.
I think the government's insistence on outsourcing a lot of these services to NDIS providers, who are fundamentally private providers in the bulk of cases, even when they're providers who have charitable standing within the community, they are all fundamentally there for the money. And whether that be money to actually provide the services or money to pay for their staff or money to pay for their social media outreach and marketing teams and all of those sorts of things. I think there's a lot of overhead that we unnecessarily inject into these sorts of things if those sorts of services could be delivered by government. But pivoting to the mutual aid and the anarchism and that sort of thing, what is government? And fundamentally, from an anarchist perspective, government is people doing for people. The community as a broader term, concept, delivering outcomes and support to people who need that support. As much as I am hesitant to quote Marx, he basically made a statement in one of his letters that basically echoes the anarchist philosophy of from each unto their capabilities and to each according to their needs, which basically says, you know, regardless of what your needs are, your community, your civilization, your government, whatever form that takes, should be ensuring your welfare, and that we all have an obligation to make sure that happens. And that's a fundamental enlightenment value that I think a lot of our governments lose track of with their technocratic outsourcing and, you know, need to break everything down to dollars and cents. Ultimately, it's outcomes that matter. And I think the idea of figuring out who's more or less deserving and creating those hierarchies of need is wildly unnecessary and something that we as a society should consider as a failure. There is a specific problem with only addressing what can be what is publicly visible. I think there's a deep problem with taking that approach, and we need to do better at seeking out those less visible outcomes and focusing on what the outcomes have been for people and what their lacks have been, not focusing on the sources of their lacks. We need to ensure that people's needs are met. That's far more important than figuring out why their needs haven't been met. And if they can find a way to meet those needs better in the future, then that's fine. But we need to solve the issue of unmet needs way further up the chain than figuring out why those needs were unmet in the first place. So I think that there needs to be a sense of values-based leadership from our governments and our government officials and our politicians and all of the above, and also from business leaders and community leaders. We all need more of a platform to be able to say, these are the values that we believe in as a civilization, as a culture, as a society, and making sure that no one's needs go unmet has to be right up the top of those values. And we're just not seeing that from our political leadership at the moment, nor are we seeing it from the press, nor are we seeing it from business.
Thank you so much for your time, Gemma.
That's all right. Hopefully my pleasure.
Visit us again. And we'll see you again on the Breadline at some time soon.
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and thank you for being engaged in what I've had to say. I really appreciated the opportunity.
Well, that was a great interview there, Danielle.
Thanks, Darryl.
Yeah, it had got to be your best one yet, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, well, let's hope keep improving. it was a really good conversation and brought up some great points. But, I totally agree with prevention and preventing people on the streets or have been through psychiatric or facing homelessness and transience, if those needs were met a lot earlier through the community. It's just a matter of what I find interesting is how that happens in an overpopulated city. Community mutualism, I guess, is something that happens easier in smaller communities. So, yeah,
that community get-togetherness, you know, that's something that's disappearing also, isn't it? And as far as the homeless, like being homeless, that doesn't do your mental health much good either. In fact,
it can be really isolating and disconnected from community. And facing that kind of I know people, the trust issue of accepting services even from reputable organisations is difficult, but being connected to community is why I'm at 3CR with you, Darryl. So
yes, yeah. Oh, great, Danielle. Yeah, all right. Well, thanks for coming in tonight and bringing in that fantastic interview.
No worries.
That's great. All right, now we're at the end of our show. Don't forget to join us again next week. You've been listening to Bradline here on 3cr.org.au.
Yes, no, we believe so.
Oh, that's that website. No, 3CR Community Radio. Yes, on 3cr.org.au. I'll get this right one time.
And I'll see you for Radiothon coming up.
Oh, yes. That's coming up next month. Our Radiothon is, if I can find it on my... Yeah, Monday, 16th of June. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.